This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In the 1970s, a genre of Hollywood movie was born that was aimed directly at African-American audiences. The movies became known as blaxploitation films, typified by flicks like Shaft in 1971.
Shaft. Hotter than Bond, cooler than Bullet. Rated R. If you want to see Shaft, ask your mama.
So you get the idea. Shaft, Sweet Sweetback's badass song, many others did well at the box office, but there were some in black communities who objected to the portrayals of African-American life in these films. In particular, the black sorority Delta Sigma Theta didn't like the way black women were being represented in these movies, and their solution was to create, write, produce, and finance a film of their own. Countdown at Cusini was released in 1976, and though many people have never heard of that film, it could have changed the way Hollywood did business. This film, and a documentary about the making of the film, will open at the Diaspora Festival of Black and Independent Film this Sunday. Joining us to talk about that film and the documentary The Cusini Concept, The Pride and Sabotage, is filmmaker S. Toriano Berry. Toriano, welcome to the State of Things.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
So tell us what intrigued you and how you found out about Countdown to Cusini. This is the 1976 film, right?
Yes.
That many of us had never heard of. Tell us how you found out about it.
Well, I first heard about Countdown to Cusini my first year at UCLA Film School. Actually, it was probably the first week. I was talking with someone who became probably my best friend there, Robert Wheaton. And he knew a whole lot more about film and film history than I did. But we were talking and found out that I'm an Omega. And he asked me if I knew about the film that the Deltas, you know, did. And I said, no, I hadn't heard about it. So he went on to tell me about the, you know, the fact that they had made a movie. And he said it was a bad movie and, you know, they lost their money. So he also mentioned about the control. The basic concept initially was they were going to use a controlled market distribution plan, basically using the chapters of the sorority to actually screen the film and set up screenings. So the concept was that if they had 85,000 members, as they had at the time, 85 times X would give you a certain amount of money that if you could make the film for that price or below, then when you made the film, put it in the theaters, or actually, you know, brought it to the chapters, the Deltas would come and support it, and that would basically break even. You'd cover your production costs. And then when you brought your, or they brought their husbands and boyfriends and children and friends, family members, coworkers, et cetera, that would all be gravy. So at the time, I'm like, whoa, that's brilliant. That's a wonderful concept. But again, you know, why and how they lost their money, I had no idea. So a few years later, I co-wrote a book with my sister, Dr. Venice Berry, called The 50 Most Influential Black Films. And of course, I made sure they Countdown at Cusini was on that list, not necessarily because it was all that influential, but of course it had such great potential to be. And I contacted Ozzie Davis, who was the film's producer and director and co-star, and I actually found out that what happened, in my opinion, was that the Deltas were actually sabotaged by the distributor, the Hollywood distributor. They basically abandoned their original concept about a four-walling or the controlled market distribution using the chapters to set up the screenings, and they went with Hollywood. And the distributor did not coordinate the release of the film with the Deltas.
Well, I want to talk more about absolutely, because that's a fascinating part of the story, but I do want to get to why the Deltas felt the need to make this film. Again, this is 1976, in the first time. And in a way, not only is it proto-marketing via a kind of social network, right, a social media network, we're going to get our chapters to show up, but the financing as well. We're going to get our chapters to pay for it. So it's crowdsourcing, right, in 1976.
Yes. Well, as it you mentioned in the opening, you know, the blaxploitation films did leave a lot to be desired when it came to the actual images, you know, of not only black people but sometimes specifically, you know, black women. And Lillian Benbow, who was the president of the organization at the time, really set up to or set out to, you know, make a difference. She had just set up the Arts and Letters Commission. And she wanted to give the Arts and Letters Commission something of merit that they could approach and that they could do, because it had members like they just jumped out of my head. Lena Horne,
mm-hmm.
You know, Lena Horne, of course, Ruby Dee, and people like that. And she really wanted to do something, you know, spectacular, and would be groundbreaking, and it definitely would have changed the way, you know, Hollywood did business. Because if Delta had made $1 million, $5 million, $10 million profit from Countdown to Cassini, then, you know, I think that, you know, many other organizations with tens of thousands of dedicated active members may have given up their, you know, fish fries and car washes mm-hmm. and bake sales, and went into filmmaking, you know, as a fundraising prospect as well. And Hollywood, I believe, would have, you know, lost their control, because you wouldn't have to go to a Hollywood studio to get financing.
And of course, this is all happening at a time when Hollywood is fretting over the loss of control anyway. Independent studios now, the studio system itself is breaking down by the mid-70s. So that's fascinating. And I do want to get to more of that part of the story. But you then do a documentary called The Cassini Concept, The Pride and Sabotage, and talk with a number of the members about their about this whole enterprise, what they thought about it at the time. Let's listen to a few of those members and what they had to say about it.
This was a bold move as a sorority, African-American at that, deciding to be an executive producer or producer of a film. It had just never been done before.
I, at the time, thought, oh, these women are so innovative. It was very inspiring for me that they were participating in the contemporary effort of media activism.
For us to even think about doing a movie was like, wow, are they gonna let us do a movie? Black women, they may not think we know what we're doing.
That's from the documentary The Cassini Concept, The Pride and the Sabotage. The film screens this Sunday at the Varsity Theater for the kickoff of the Diaspora Film Festival of Black and Independent Film, sponsored by the—and we'll talk about the sponsorship of that film. Both films screen at the Stone Center's Diaspora Film Festival of Black and Independent Film. We'll talk more about that. But I'm here with the filmmaker right now, S. Toriano Berry. Let's talk more about these films themselves, the blaxploitation films. Give us a better sense of what they were and what was happening here in the early to mid-70s and what these films were all about.
Right. Well, like you mentioned, you know, Hollywood was kind of, you know, on shaky ground at that time anyway, because along with a lot of the independent production companies coming along, they were also being, you know, reeled or being railed by television. You know, television had come out in the 50s, you know, had really kind of caught on in the 60s, you know, and by that time, you know, the early 70s, you know, a lot of people were staying home watching television instead of going to the movie theaters. So a lot of the research I've done actually states that these blaxploitation films actually saved a lot of the Hollywood studios from going bankrupt. And of course, blaxploitation films themselves, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, it came out of Sweet Sweet Back's Badass Song, Melvin Van Peebles film, kind of came out of a vacuum, you know, and kicked everything off. But there were actually several films that came out in 1970, you know, including Tick, 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 you know, with James Brown, and Cotton Comes to Harlem, The Liberation of L.B. Jones, the sequel to In the Heat of the Night, They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, came out in 1970. And, of course, these were, you know, comedy and regular dramas, you know, basic drama stories and comedies. But then when Sweet Sweetback came out and had lines going around the block and the whole, you know, anti-hero character, you know, fighting against the system and the man, you know, kind of kicked it into that different direction. And then, of course, Shaft came in and then Shoot Superfly, and basically blaxploitation was off to the races.
So let's talk about the objection to this, because you talk with one of the things that Delta Sigma Theta were pushing back against was this idea that the way women were represented in these films. And you talk with Robin Means Coleman, who tells us a little bit about what was happening and the thought process behind the film.
Blaxploitation films were typically low budget, had extraordinary representations of violence, often didn't present the black community well, and specifically the image of women was really troubling, of black women. And so Delta is seeking to, again, intervene on these troublesome narratives that cast the black community generally as deficient and deviant, and said, we're about doing something different.
That's University of Michigan professor Robin Means Coleman from the documentary The Cusini Concept, The Pride and Sabotage. And I'm talking with filmmaker S. Toriano Berry. So tell us more now about the production of the film. It's a great concept. We've got enough people here. Let's do the math. If everybody buys a ticket and brings a boyfriend, here's how much we can make. We can make a budget, right? And we can make a couple of extra based on that. So where's the film? Because interestingly enough, this film is actually shot in Africa. So give us more of the details now of the production of this film.
Okay. Well, of course, with their, visionary, concept, from the beginning, of course, they also wanted to actually link, America, or the American, African-American, society with Africa, the motherland. And so the story, of course, is about a jazz musician, an American jazz musician who's touring Africa. He becomes involved with a beautiful revolutionary who is the Ruby Dee character, and he gets involved into kind of protecting this rebel leader. And so with it being, shot in Africa, of course, that added a whole lot of other, problems as far as when it came to production. And one of the additional avenues that I believe also played into the possible sabotage angle was that the first time they actually had to go back to Africa to shoot twice, because the first time they went, the film equipment, the cameras, the lights, and everything that was coming from France was somehow shipped to the wrong dock. So it took them two to 3 weeks before they could find out where the equipment was and get started. And so therefore, they were actually several weeks late in starting production. And then the rainy season came, and they had to cease production. In fact, at that time, Al Freeman Jr., that was the lead actor at that time. So they had to leave. They didn't complete the film. Ms. Bimbo basically was adamant, said, no, we have to complete this film. So they went back and raised more money, and they sent them back. And the second time they sent them back, then Greg Morris was actually the lead actor at that
Mission
time.
Impossible.
Yes. So he was the lead. And they basically did, they got the film made. And unfortunately, within that time frame, Ms. Bimbo, they had an election, and she was no longer president by the time the film came out. So she no longer had any power. Then, of course, with the distributor, with them abandoning the controlled market concept and four-walling the film, maintaining control of the distribution, and gave that control over to Hollywood, who, again, I believe, did not want them to succeed, then the administration that came in after her really kind of just dropped the project and moved on.
Right. Well, talk about that and give us an example, because I know the idea was we're going to show this film, we're going to get everybody in our chapters in various cities ready for this, then show the film in that city. And that was the plan for the controlled distribution. When Hollywood took over the distribution, they just shot the film out, and of course that whole plan fell to ruin. And there's a really good example of that where the whole city, including the mayor, was ready and the film never showed up. Tell us about that.
Yes, that is a story that I was told to by Dr. Jean Noble, who at the time they made the film, she was actually president of the Arts and chairman of the Arts and Letters Commission. And she said that, again, I can't remember exactly which city it was, but let's say it was Nashville I use. So they were supposed to have a premiere at Nashville. And she said it was standing room only. Like you said, the mayor and the governor and all these important people were there. They had those lights out in front of the theater, that go through the sky and put all these beams through the sky. Said everything was ready. And the film print never showed up. And they found out the next day that they had, opened the film in Omaha or something and didn't even tell anyone.
Well, I'm talking to S. Toriano Berry, a filmmaker behind the documentary The Cusini Concept, The Pride and Sabotage. Gives a behind-the-scenes look at a 1976 film, Countdown at Cusini. Both films screen at the Stone Center's Diaspora Film Festival of Black and Independent Film. And joining the conversation now is Joseph Jordan, who is the director of the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at UNC Chapel Hill, a professor of African and African American Studies and Diaspora Studies at UNC. Welcome back. Good day.
Thank you
here.
So much.
Tell us about the importance of that film, do you think? A film that we know really was not a commercial success at all. Should we be paying attention to it?
I think absolutely. I mean, this is a moment when you see a kind of birth of the notion that communities can not only develop their own resources, but can manage them. And that was no less true in the cultural realm. And, I mean, just as it is now, back then, film was a very, very powerful influence on how culture developed. And this is one of the reasons I think the Deltas were so interested in grabbing the reins of that engine and trying to figure out better ways to create images that were probably more reflective of what was really happening in people's lives.
And if you look at the whole picture, they got control of an awful lot of it when it came to the production of the film and the financing and a distribution plan, which is all part of the pro forma. But because you don't have control of the whole corporation, right,
exactly.
The distribution, that was one link, and that's where the whole thing falls down.
Right. I'll tell you that if you look back at the era and if you look at the major black communication outlets of the time, you know, Ebony, Jet, all of the radio stations, folks were excited. Folks were really, really excited about not only the fact that this film was coming out, but that the Deltas had done it, and they were celebrated. I mean, I was there. You know, it's not something I'm going to brag about very much because I was in graduate school at the time, but this was a big event. It was a very, very big event. I mean, I look at all of the excitement around things like Black Panther and how people were expectant of what it was going to be. It was the same feeling back then in the black community especially.
Let's take a look back at the so-called blaxploitation films themselves, because I know we want to talk about the historic importance of that film, the Cassini Project concept. But that was a kind of a double-edged sword because there were these negative stereotypes. On the other hand, for the first time ever, there were nearly all black casts. There were characters who were the lead characters in films, however cartoonish they may have been. So this is kind of a mixed bag in this period, isn't it, in some ways?
Right. And you know, the Stone Center has been fortunate to have some of the directors and some of the people who are film historians and talk about the period. And I'm not really of the mind that it's really that much different than it is today, that there were various kinds of films available to us. Oftentimes, however, some of those that were much more violent, that were a little bit simpler and less nuanced in the plots. But if you look at it, and one of the things I also want to mention is that the true film historian at UNC of black film is Dr. Charlene Register, and she's going to be with us at this program, so she'll be able to talk more about it. But if you look at it, you had people like Alex Haley who were doing screenplays for some of these films. You had the great Gordon Parks working in these films. You had people like Diane Carroll. I mean, some of the most important film and theater actors, writers, and directors were participants, and they will tell you, you know, we were working, you know, after not being able to find roles in films out of Hollywood at the time, when these opportunities came along, many of them not only took the roles, but they used the support that they received there to then go on and make other kinds of films that I might argue were probably superior to some of the things that were coming out in Hollywood itself.
What about the lessons from this film in an era where the production and some of the financing can be more decentralized? We think of it that way. Are there lessons that can be learned from this and a kind of a genealogy? Does this film move forward now in the age of social media?
I think it already has, and I think sometimes those legacies aren't always apparent to us. I think if you look at young black filmmakers today and other filmmakers of color, they've already taken those lessons. They're already doing it themselves. They're already figuring out ways to bring community support into the equation. And some of the most important films that are now featured on these, you know, these online and digital platforms. Yeah, come out of that legacy.
I want to thank you, Joseph Jordan, the director of the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History, and also S. Toriano Berry, a filmmaker behind the documentary The Cassini Concept, The Pride and Sabotage. Thank you both for being on the program.
All right.
Hey, great being there.
All right. Thank you.
Countdown at Cassini opens at the Stone Center's 2018 Diaspora Film Festival of Black and Independent Film, and you can find out where to see it this weekend. Yeah, Sunday at the Varsity Theater at 4 o'clock. Check out our website, stateofthings.org. There's more of our program just ahead. Stay tuned.